now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I'm your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we'll be talking with Dina Imlay, who is Director of Voter Services for the Charlottesville chapter of the League of Women Voters. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming in today to talk to me. So I want to start out, as we get going here, with some information about the League of Women Voters. What is it? How did it come into being?
Well, I have a dissertation here. I could start with George Washington and move along.
You know, I think a little brief mention of George Washington might not be out of order.
All right. Well, ought to say that women in this country have really been going for equal rights for a long time, and the women in the revolutionary times actually were writing about all of this, and Mary Wollstonecraft back in the Revolutionary War days was writing The Vindication of the Rights of Women, and this was considered a pretty radical tract at the time, but it galvanized the women in the colonies and in this country. And there's been a sort of an arc of history since then, which, you know, ends today with our current election.
So did women vote for George Washington?
No, because at that time, the people who could vote were white, male, and owned land.
Seriously?
Yes.
So, like, absolutely. Not only could women not vote, but even white men who didn't own real property couldn't
absolutely.
Vote.
Absolutely. It was a kind of government run by a lot of white men who owned land.
It was a plutocracy.
They wrote, exactly, and they were the ones that wrote the Constitution, and so that's how it worked out.
I see. We'll talk a little bit about how we got to the point where women vote. I mean, what happened to the franchise in the United States from that from those founding fathers and their great tracts of land to today?
Well, of course, during all of this time and before, we had a slave trade and we had slavery in this country. So we had a whole population of people that were obviously not voters.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't until the 15th Amendment, which was, I think, around Ulysses S. Grant time, around 1870, I think, that they had the 15th Amendment, which allowed African-American men to vote. Anybody formerly enslaved could now vote. But
did they have to own land?
Women.
Did the African-American men have to own land?
No, they did not. But they were allowed, as African-American men, to vote. Women were not specified in that amendment.
What happened in between there to the white men who didn't own land? Was there a change before the 15th Amendment, or did the 15th Amendment sort of create the vote for African-American men and white men who didn't own land?
Well, anything pertaining to the right to vote came up in the 15th Amendment.
Okay.
And in gender really didn't become an issue until till much later.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, not until 1920.
So how'd we get there? What happened in between?
Well, there was just a lot of interest on the part of women during this time and having this right to vote happen. And
you say a lot of interest. You know, I'm not sure a lot of interest really covers what happened in between there.
I'm understating.
Tell it, sister. Tell me about what happened. What'd they do?
In 1848, they had a little conference with, the Seneca Falls, New York Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about 300 men and women who met to talk about the status of women. And people during that time were abolitionists and suffragists that formed this group.
What's a suffragist?
Well, a suffragist is someone who believes that, you know, there is a right to vote for people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the people that were lobbying for this were the women who didn't have the right to vote. People like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was an early abolitionist, and Susan B. Anthony were probably names you remember from the history books.
There were some. Were there some silver dollars with Susan B. Anthony's?
Well, finally,
image
she
on
was
them?
Put on a coin. Yes.
Yes.
Well, the suffrage movement really took off because after 1870, a lot of the Western territories were allowing women to vote. You know, I suppose they felt if you got in a covered wagon and got that far, you were pretty tough and you knew what you were doing and so forth. At any rate, the first Western territory, at that time they weren't states, was Wyoming. And from there, you know, various Utah and Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, whatnot, were all allowing women to vote.
Well, those Western territories were also opposed to slavery very early on.
Yes.
I mean, you had a lot of abolitionists who went out west, and with those ideals came the ideals of equality for women as well.
Well, that's right. There was a commonality there in thought. Well, actually, then things began to be a little more radical in England, certainly in the early 20th century, with people like Pankhurst being the leader of the suffrage movement in England. They were realizing that just having sweet little conferences in Seneca Falls just wasn't going to cut it. And so they began to agitate and realize that they had to engage in civil disobedience, that that was where they had to go with their efforts.
It was a protest movement.
It was a protest movement. And so they, you know, committed arson.
They committed arson?
They committed arson.
Tell me about the suffragettes who committed arson.
Well, there's actually a movie that depicts this.
Really?
Was, you know, put out a year or two ago called The Suffragettes. And they would put letter bombs in mailboxes. They would do all kinds of things to get attention.
Wow.
And so
I think we call that domestic terrorism these
days. Well, you know, I think a group of people really felt that they were stepping over their bounds. But Alice Paul, who was an American, she was a Quaker from New Jersey, went to England, and she was part of this movement. She saw what they did. She saw their tactics. And she came back to this country, and she decided that civil disobedience was going to be the way to go. So some of these ladies chained themselves to the White House fence and held a sign, a pretty radical sign, that said, women deserve the right to vote, in so many words.
Okay.
And they were, chains were cut. They were dragged off in a paddy wagon and put in one of the worst jails, prisons in D.C.
Now, this part I've heard before. I had not heard about the letter bombs and the arson.
Well, that didn't happen in this country.
That wasn't in the U.S.
No.
That was British. Okay.
But the civil disobedience tactics, you know, they wanted to be taken as political prisoners. They didn't want to be put in with criminals. And so they thought that by being labeled as political prisoners, that that would mean that they wouldn't have to wear prison garb. They wouldn't have to be housed with the other people in the prison. And they would get certain dispensations. But
how'd that go for them?
Well, it didn't work well because Alice Paul was pretty hard-headed, and she wouldn't allow the women guards, prison guards, to take her clothes off. She said, I'm a political prisoner, you know, and I'm not going to be wearing prison garb.
Right.
So after fighting them off, male prison guards came into the picture. And this, of course, when this the word got out about
well, that's,
this.
Was, that will make a definite political point right there.
There was quite a bit of impropriety.
It's a way to get some press coverage.
And they did. But actually, there was a period when Alice Paul was being force-fed. In fact, she was force-fed for a month, and nobody knew where she was and what was happening.
Right.
Until somehow they got word out to the newspapers.
When you say force-fed, it's because she went on a hunger strike, right? She basically said, I'm not going to eat.
And they said, yes, you are.
I mean, I'm laughing, but not really funny.
It was a very serious time, and women were taking a lot of risks and exposing themselves to a lot of danger. And so this went on, and people like Carrie Catt came into the picture. She was an American who helped during the 19-teens, World War One, working up to 1920.
Mm-hmm.
They were going for getting a 19th Amendment, which gave the women explicitly the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
There was women's suffrage at that point. And as soon as it was ratified, the League of Women Voters came into being.
Well, the League of Women Voters sounds wildly radical.
Well, they were tame compared to before and after, because you know that as time went by, we got into the 1960s
mm-hmm.
and the 1970s, and there was a very active feminist movement that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we all read Sexual Politics by Kate Millett.
Kate Millett, yes.
Yes. And so actually, I think the only bright spot after that for a while was in 1984, when Geraldine Ferraro was named as vice presidential candidate for Walter Mondale.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time that a woman was in the top ticket for national politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they didn't win, but it was a real statement. And so, of course, today we have a very unusual, and I would say the League of Women Voters would say, a welcome change in that there is finally, after all of these years, a woman who has been nominated to be the presidential candidate for a major political party.
Well, you know, when I hear you sort of detail the history that led up to the League of Women Voters, I think this organization must be a real firebrand, radical. But that's not my impression of the League of Women Voters. So what's the story?
Well, we are a small but mighty group. And actually, as it is almost 100 years old now, the League of Women Voters has some members that have been members throughout their life.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, in Charlottesville, the league started in 1946. So we're celebrating our 70th anniversary here in Charlottesville. And in those days, post-war, the 50s and so forth, many women were not in the workforce, but they were intellectually alert and looking for some kind of mental stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And something like the League of Women Voters captured their interest, and they became active in all kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. When you mention, though, when we talk about the sort of radicalism of it, I think about NOW as a radical feminist organization. I don't think of the League of Women Voters as a radical feminist organization.
No, that's correct. The National Organization for Women grew out of the 70s when I think when we were just realizing that being sweet and having little conferences and things were, and finally getting the 19th Amendment weren't really enough.
Mm-hmm.
Is there's still a divide between men and women in the workforce, in society in general.
Sort of a glass ceiling kind of thing.
Glass ceiling. And so that's why the League of Women Voters, which doesn't take a stand in endorsing any candidate, has actually this year commented on Hillary Clinton securing the Democratic presidential nomination. And they say things like, the League, along with all of our fellow Americans, must celebrate this historic event of a woman receiving the presidential nomination of a major political party. It's always been a goal, the League of Women Voters, to enable women to have an equal role in our nation's political processes. It may have taken nearly 100 years since the first step of women receiving the right to vote, but that can't diminish the historic significance of this moment and this achievement.
Do you think the League of Women Voters would have issued the same statement if the woman candidate had been a Republican?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's a landmark to have a woman be considered qualified to get the nomination of a major political party. I mean, the League of Women Voters fundamentally believes that our democracy works best when all Americans of all backgrounds have the opportunity to fully participate in all aspects of our national political processes. And this important moment sends the message that in this democracy, women finally are full participants in all aspects of the democratic processes.
So the League of Women Voters is completely nonpartisan.
Totally.
And do you have Republican members of the League of Women Voters?
We have Republican members. We have independents. We have Green Party members. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, this year, the Green Party at the top of the ticket has Jill Stein.
We had Jill Stein on the show.
You did.
A little while ago. Yes,
well,
we did.
I'm in good company.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Another thing that is happening right now, I mean, there's the presidential race. And, of course, we have our first female candidate for president. But there are a lot of interesting down-ballot races as well. And here in Charlottesville, we're in the 5th District. And the 5th District has a woman running for a congressional House seat.
As a matter of fact, it happens to be Jane Dittmar, who is from the area. She's running in a district which, interestingly enough, is the largest congressional district in the state of Virginia.
The 5th District's kind of interesting. Talk a little bit about the shape of the 5th District.
Well, it looks like a pencil running from Fauquier County to Danville, which is the North Carolina border. It is the largest geographically, and it's actually the size of New Jersey or the size of Vermont.
It's a big district.
Generally a large district, not as populous as some of the other districts, but geographically it's a real challenge for the candidates because they have 5 or 6 hours of traveling just to get from one end of the district to another. This district this year is especially interesting here in Virginia because, in my opinion, we have gerrymandered districts, which means that a party in power, and it can be either party, when they are in power, they draw the districts to favor their party. And their
I was going to say, I don't think the 5th District looks like a pencil. I think the 5th District looks like a Rush Arch ink blot.
They all do in some form or other. But this year, we don't have an incumbent running in the race for U.S. House of Representatives.
Whose seat was that? Who has been in it?
That was Robert Hurt's seat. And now the Republicans have nominated Tom Garrett. And
what happened to Robert Hurt?
He resigned. I mean, he is saying, and he didn't resign, he's saying that he's not going to run mm-hmm. for another term. And I'm not sure why.
We don't know why that is.
We don't know why. Okay. I don't know why. But he was our representative for several terms, mm-hmm. and he was a member of the Freedom Caucus.
Okay. What's the Freedom Caucus?
Well, the Freedom Caucus is a sort of a splinter group, maybe you wouldn't call it that, of the Republican Party that's ultra-conservative. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, a few years ago, you'll remember that they voted to shut down the federal government.
Oh, is that who the Freedom Caucus is?
Well, they helped with that decision. And really costing us, I think, a few billion, possibly as many billion as $6 billion, with a B, dollars to do that. Of course, that was when the sequester was, brought into being, where they just said, okay, we're not paying for a lot of things right now.
So we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. So we are back on the air with Straight Talk. My guest is Dina Imlay, who's Director of Voter Services for the Charlottesville chapter of the League of Women Voters. And we were just talking about the 5th District. So Robert Hurt is not running again, which leaves Tom Garrett and Jane Dittmar competing for that seat, which is a very oddly shaped district, a very geographically significant district, but not a terribly populous district. Talk to me a little bit about that race. Is there an event coming up in that race? I know there is.
I'm so glad you asked. There have been in the Albemarle and surrounding areas already 3 forums. There was one very recently at the PVCC, the community college here.
Mm-hmm.
There has been one at the Batten School at UVA, and there was one sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. So we, the League of Women Voters, are sponsoring the 4th and I believe the final one in the area. And this will be this coming Tuesday, October 18th, from 6 to 8 p.m. It will be at the William Monroe High School Performing Arts Center in Stanardsville.
So Greene County, we're going to have this event in Greene County. And when you say forum, you know, what I think most people would say is it's a debate, basically.
Well, that's what people would say. But as you know, from what we've had over the years, the recent years, is it's not truly a debate.
What's the difference?
Well, a debate is when two individuals with opposing views speak independently from one another to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go on for a longer period of time to present their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other person in the debate answers that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a back and forth with refuting and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What we've really had in recent times, and certainly when there were television debates, is more of a forum. In some cases, it was conducted by a moderator. In some cases, it was a panel of people asking questions of the candidates. And so they really didn't debate back and forth. I did notice that was very interesting. I like this rule that they used at PVCC in which their question was asked and each candidate had a couple of minutes to answer it. Each had the equal time.
Mm-hmm.
But if one candidate mentioned the other in their reply, the person mentioned would have a minute to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So it really wasn't truly a debate back and forth, but it was a chance to have some kind of an exchange.
I'm not sure how that's different than what I think of as a debate, how the forum and the debate differ from each other. I'm still not clear on that.
Well, in a debate, let's say the Lincoln and Douglas debates, there was no moderator. There was no panel asking questions, just the two.
But, for example, the presidential debates that so many Americans have been watching this season, there have been moderators. Anderson Cooper moderated the last one, and I don't remember who it was that moderated the first one, but there was a body there asking questions and trying to keep everybody on track and on time.
Right. Well, apparently in the Lincoln and Douglas debates, they didn't need someone to keep them on time.
Well,
they did run long, I must say. It was the Oxford style of debate. A very strict style, and it is what has happened with the what we'll call, if you want to, the debates, is that the parties have gotten involved, and there now is a commission on presidential debates that sets the rules and sets the format and so forth. So we had what we see this year. We have individual moderators, and we have a pair of moderators conducting and complying with whatever rules were agreed to by the individual candidates. They all have to agree to the format, and I think this year there was some question about whether each candidate was going to agree to the moderators, to the format, to the date and time.
Right.
And
it's getting harder to agree on anything, isn't
it? Well, it certainly, I mean, you can't even agree on a format for discussing your views. It is really, we've devolved to that.
Who's going to moderate the debate on Tuesday night in Greene County between Dittmar and Guerra?
This will be a member of the League of Women Voters, Deborah Horde.
Tell me a little bit about Deborah.
Well, she is she has moderated for us before. We hold a legislative luncheon once a year in which we invite the local Virginia legislators to come and speak to us about what they've accomplished in the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And we host this every year, and Deborah's been a very good moderator for that. She's going to do the same format as being used nationally now, mm-hmm. which is, you know, questions timed responses. We will introduce one question that will be directed to one candidate this year,
mm-hmm.
so that Tom Garrett will get a question that pertains to his points of view or what he knows about, and mm-hmm. one will be to Jane Dittmar, again, mm-hmm. something that's strictly something she can answer.
Mm-hmm.
Then we will throw the whole event open to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have little 3x5 cards in which they can jot down questions. We don't want an open mic. That's sort of a prescription for disaster mm-hmm. sometimes. So we do, for a little control, we do monitor what's being presented to the moderator to ask.
I'm smiling because this radio show started with a debate between the two candidates for Commonwealth Attorney in Albemarle County. And we took calls, and it was the first, maybe it was the second show we did, but it was right at the very beginning of the show. And wow, we didn't have any way to screen the calls, and we got some doozies.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
I can see why you might not want to go that route.
Well, and we don't have a hook to drag people off the stage either.
Right.
So well, and when we collect them, then we organize them for, you know, we cut out duplications
mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort them for proper language and so forth. And so mm-hmm. there'll be a few of those at the end.
So people who go to this event on this coming Tuesday night at the high school in Greene County, people who go to that event, when they arrive, they'll be given a 3x5 card, and they can write down a question that they would like to be asked. And those cards will be turned in at some point in the debate. And then someone will go through them and pick questions out of the cards to ask kind of at the end of the debate, the last half hour or so.
Exactly, exactly.
Who makes the selections? Who gets to decide what question gets asked?
Well, it really, we start from the top in terms of audience questions. Mm-hmm. We start from the top, one that's not a duplicate question, just sort of randomly, and work through as many as we have time for. The moderator is given these cards, and mm-hmm. she just starts at the top.
But does anybody go? Somebody goes through them and weeds out the duplicates, right?
Right.
So, and they weed through them before they give them to her?
Yes, they do.
I mean, somebody put a card on the top and put a card on the bottom.
Well, one thing we also don't want to duplicate is what's already been asked by the moderators. I mean, it seems that 2 hours is a long time, but it really turns out to not even be enough to cover what you want to know about each candidate, what their positions are. So
right.
We don't want to have questions from the audience that have already been covered.
Of course.
We do want to cover things that we haven't.
Let's say you've got 20 good questions, right? You don't have time in half an hour to ask and answer 20 good questions.
Don't.
Who decides which ones get asked?
Well, I guess a combination of members of the league, the people that collect them,
mm-hmm.
and the moderator.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I guess the moderator's sitting there with them, and she can look at them and go, I'm going to ask that one.
Well, I think we just really sort them, and as I say, it is random, and we go from the top of the stack to the bottom. You know, this year is, if I may switch gears a little bit, is going to be a year where we have to be concerned. I mean, part of what we're doing with forums is to inform people, but also to stimulate people to think about the election, to know about it, and to actually go out and vote. So this year, there are a group of millennials that mm-hmm. are larger. The millennials are a larger group of voters than the boomers.
That is a first, isn't it, in this election?
It seems to be. There are just a lot of millennials that will really have a big impact on the election.
You
on
young people.
Choice. Yes, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, to that end, mm-hmm. the University of Virginia and PVCC are doing their part in organizing, getting people, getting all the students and people on campus other than the students to register to vote. And in fact, there's a very active campaign of, you know, getting out the vote. Katie Brandon from UVA is from one of their student council members is organizing things like dorms having laptops where they can register to vote online.
Wait. Katie Brandon is a student at
yes,
UVA?
She is.
She's a student, and she's organizing a get out the vote effort for other students at UVA.
Yes, she
including
is.
Laptops at the dorms for people to register.
And she's also thought of something I think rather clever. There is a transportation system to get students in various times around campus. And so, I guess here we call it the grounds.
Uh-huh.
And so they will be employed to get first-year students from the dorms to the polls.
And where would the polls be for students who are living in the dorms?
Well, it would probably be at U-Hall, at University Hall. If you need to know, anybody would like to know where your poll is, you can go to vote411.org, which mm-hmm. is one of a number of websites, but it's the League of Women Voters website. You can plug in your address, and it'll tell you where your polling place is. It'll tell you what's on your ballot, because each ballot is different.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, this year in Albemarle County, they vote on a bond referendum.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in any other county or city votes on this particular referendum,
right?
Which says, may we finance our school capital improvements
with a bond.
With a bond.
I want to get to that a little later in the show in terms of what's on the ballot this year. But I want to talk a little more about what's going on at UVA. Is PVCC doing something like this as well?
Well, one thing that's interesting at PVCC, and I'm not sure whether they're doing some of the same things as UVA, but some of the professors, both at UVA and at PVCC, are organizing their students, having the students help get out the word at the respective schools.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, at the recent PVCC forum, they had students who were asking the questions from the audience rather than the audience
mm-hmm,
itself.
Mm-hmm.
So they were representing the audience by asking questions. And I thought that was a clever way of doing it. And also, it involves students in the civic practice of how an election goes,
mm-hmm.
from candidacy to having the voting process. And one of the good things now is that you can register to vote online, which is something you can also do with vote411.org. The reason it's called vote411 is because 411, everyone knows, is the information. So it's vote411.org.
So information about voting, including the ability to register online and find out where your polling place is and everything else.
Exactly.
You know, when I was a student at UVA, oh, many dark years ago, I remember voting by absentee ballot because I was registered to vote where my parents lived, where I grew up. How does that work? Do the students get to decide where they're registered? Can they register in Charlottesville or Albemarle? Or
well, of course, they have to choose. They do need to choose
yes.
whether they're going to be registering at their home
mm-hmm.
or at their university. But when they do choose, they can vote in person, or they can vote absentee.
Where are most of the dorms? Are they in the city or the county at UVA?
Well,
maybe varies.
The university, I think, is almost a separate entity, but I suppose it's considered more county.
It's got to be. I mean, I guess it just depends on the geographic location of the actual dorm room that you're in.
Well, they can go to vote411.org,
find
their
out.
Address, and get their polling place. One of the things besides getting out the vote that is concerning, because getting out the vote just means that anyone who wants to vote is able to do that. And you know that recent times, there's been a lot of voter suppression. I mean, not only in recent times, but, you know, years ago, there was a poll tax. There was a literacy test before you could actually vote at the polls. And this was a way of keeping people from voting that they...
Well, this was after the 15th Amendment was passed and suddenly black men could vote. The Dixiecrats didn't want them to vote, and so they put up sort of artificial barriers. Yes, the Constitution says you can vote, but here, in order to qualify, you must recite the preamble to the Constitution. You must write all kinds of things that they themselves couldn't do. Or literacy to the extent that there was a legitimate literacy application. Why does that mean you can't vote? But these things were done because they had a racist effect. They had the effect of discriminating on the basis of race without actually being written in terms of discrimination on the basis of race.
Well, and also I think there were certain states and some of them in the South that were seen to be problem areas. And so the Supreme Court has decided they were not going to identify any particular state and say that they have to be looked at more closely. This kind of abuse can really happen in any state.
Well, now you're talking about the Voting Rights Act case that came out
exactly
fairly recently. Up until very recently, there was something called the Voting Rights Act. Well, it still exists, but certain provisions of it required certain geographic areas to have changes to their voting rules approved before they could be implemented. And this was designed to prevent that sort of, now we're going to make a literacy test, now we're going to make this, now we're going to make that, right? And every time you would make it, it would apply, and then the election would be over by the time it was ruled unconstitutional, and they'd just come up with something else that would apply next time, and so it would keep getting repeated. And so the Voting Rights Act said, you can't do that. These local areas, you have to have, these states, really, you have to have pre-approval before you can make changes to your voting rules.
Well, we have
and
a
the
modern,
U.S. Supreme Court just kicked that down.
We do have modern-day voter suppression, however. As you see, there's a rash of effort to have photo IDs.
Yes.
You must carry a government-issued photo ID.
Right.
And this, again, gets at a population of people that are elderly. It's not easy for them to go and get a picture taken that is authorized.
Well, it keeps poor people from voting.
It gets poor people from voting who may have to work for a living and not get in a car and go to the DMV or to go to the registrar.
Well, that's happening right now in Florida with the hurricane damage, right? There was all this flooding, and it happened around the time the voter registration deadline was running. And the governor said, nope, I'm not extending that deadline. And then it was litigated, and the court said, oh, yes, you are, and required them, in fact, to extend it by what, a week, 2 weeks?
Yes, well, it was extended. And it's kind of interesting that state by state voting is really regulated individually. And so there's no federal, one can't say, oh, in Ohio, you must have the polls open a certain number of hours. You must have early voting. You must have special dates, because it's up to the Secretary of State of each state.
So we are going to take a brief break, and we'll be back in just a moment with Straight Talk. So we are back on the air with Straight Talk. My guest today is Dina M. Lay, who is with the League of Women Voters, Charlottesville chapter. She's the Director of Voter Services, and we are talking about the league, and we're talking about the franchise, and we're talking about the election and all kinds of good stuff. One of the things I wanted to get to with you was the ballot itself. You alluded earlier to the fact that everybody's ballot is different depending on what locality you're in. For example, Albemarle has a bond issue. And Albemarle's bond issue is a significant bond. And it's I think I got a postcard or a notice about it or something, and it was to affect 25 of the 26 schools in Albemarle County. What? I don't know why it's 25 of the 26, but do you?
Well, They need capital improvement in almost.
And one of them doesn't?
All of the ones that are going to have capital improvements have been identified as.
Do you know which school doesn't need capital improvements in Albemarle?
I actually don't.
Neither do I.
That they're going to get, if they get the bond passed, they're going to get $35 million to improve things.
Now, what is a bond? I mean, I don't want to go into a whole crazy long explanation here, but a bond is basically a way of funding the structure, the improvement, the enhancements. Is that right?
That's correct. And financing is a lot less expensive when
right.
you have a bond.
It's a way for the government to get cheap money to make the changes to the schools that need to be made. And so that's happening in Albemarle. But there are, I'm more fascinated with the fact that we have two constitutional amendments on the ballot. And not just in Albemarle, statewide, we have two proposed amendments to the Constitution of Virginia. And I'm going to get on my soapbox here for just a second because I don't know, I have it and I can't resist. The Constitution, the state Constitution, in the U.S. Constitution, the main articles of the Constitution are about the structure of government, right? How the institutions of government shall be structured, how many people, it's really kind of boring reading, but it sets up Congress, it sets up the court, it sets up the executive branch. And then there is tacked on to the end my favorite part, which is the Bill of Rights. Then after the Bill of Rights, there are other amendments, right? But the first 10 amendments to the Constitution are the Bill of Rights, and they basically say, you know, individual people have these certain rights, like freedom of the press, like the Second Amendment right to firearms, like the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And however you feel about these rights, that's the kind of thing that's in there. So structure of government and sort of fundamental rights and liberties of individuals. In Virginia, we have the same structure, but it's the opposite. In that the Constitution itself, Article 1 of the Virginia Constitution, begins with basically the state's version of the Bill of Rights. So here in Virginia, we thought that those rights and liberties were so important, we wanted to begin the Constitution with them, not tack them on to the end. And then what follows those various rights are the following articles, which are about the structure of government. These two amendments that are being proposed... can you tell us a little bit about what the two amendments are?
Yes. These are actually in law already.
Mm-hmm.
One has to do with tax relief, and it's talking about allowing tax relief for widows of those who've served and died in the military in a conflict.
Okay.
Or... Now, the first responders, if they've died in action.
So basically police, firefighters, you know, if your husband or wife dies in this line of duty, then you're entitled to certain preferential tax treatment.
Exactly. Now, I'm not familiar with all the ins and outs of that law because I don't know if you have to be living in Virginia, mm-hmm. For instance, or...
Are these amendments on the vote411.org
yes,
site?
Yes, they are, in detail. And so
you can actually read the
language. You can
language.
Read the language. And the other amendment has to do with right to work.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia is a sort of a right to work state.
I just love that phrase. It feels very Orwellian to me. Right to work, it's like the Ministry of Truth. You know, right to work basically, you know, from my perspective anyway, and I can say this because I'm not nonpartisan, means that you can be fired for pretty much any reason that is not constitutionally prohibited. For example, you can't say, I'm going to fire you because you're black, but you can say, I'm going to fire you because I don't like the shoes you're wearing. And that's the essence of right to work, which to me just blows me away that's what we call it. But go ahead.
Well, it has to do also with organizing.
Right. Well, that's what the amendment has to do with.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so these two amendments are proposed to be enshrined in the state constitution when they're already laws.
That both of these amendments, the text of both of these amendments, are already statutes? The General Assembly has passed these laws and they're already in effect?
That's my understanding, although I think they're amplifying the tax relief one.
So it might be changed a little bit.
But the law itself can always be changed. I mean, it's very easy to change a law. It's almost impossible.
I wasn't aware
to change
that the
an amendment.
I wasn't aware that the substance of these proposed amendments was actually statute in Virginia already. That's an interesting point. That's something I hadn't known. But what strikes me about these things is that, however you feel, and I think it bears mentioning that the right to work, so to speak, amendment is about abolishing unions. It's about abolishing organized labor, basically making it so that you can't have labor unions in Virginia. And so it's not just, I mean, that's the basic tenet of that amendment. And these two things, the existence of labor unions and how to govern them, and the real estate tax treatment of widows of first responders and military, don't strike me as either a sort of fundamental rights of humanity or a structure of our government kind of issue. And so I don't understand why these are constitutional amendments.
Well, they're proposed.
Well, yes. Why?
Well, I don't know that, but there is a provision in there for having local localities be able to change things if they want to. And so I think there's a little flexibility there so that if there's a new administration in a municipality, they have that possibility. So vote411.org is a very good way of finding exactly what the wording is. And in fact, you can sort of do a mock ballot so that you have...
How do you do that? Can you walk us through that on the site? We're pulling it up here right now.
Oh, all right. Well,
let's go to 411.org, Virginia.
I'm not actually looking at it, but I know that to get any information, you put in your address.
No, you had it.
And that will bring up... many things. One is what's on your ballot.
Okay, let's enter our address here at the station. What are we, 255 Zan Road? We're gonna enter it in the computer right now while we're talking. We're just, you know, this is the kind of thing you can do on live radio, so why not? And we're in Virginia. There we go. I'm putting my producer on the spot here. Let's see what we got. Do-do-do, on your ballot, get personalized information on candidates and issues. Let's see what we got there. Click on that link for me. Personalized ballot. No kidding. Oh, my goodness. Tax relief constitutional amendment, right to work constitutional amendment. Click on that right to work constitutional amendment. Third one, yep, that's it. Let's take a peek at that. So here's how the constitutional amendment is written. It reads, should Article 1 of the Constitution of Virginia be amended to prohibit any agreement or combination between an employer and a labor union or labor organization whereby non-members of the union organization are denied the right to work for the employer. Denied the right to work for the... I love how they put that. Membership to the union or organization is made a condition of employment or continuation of employment by such employer, or the union or organization acquires an employment monopoly in any such enterprise. And that's what you're going to see when you go into the polls. That's the amendment that's going to be on there. And what is amazing to me about this, I've seen a proliferation of constitutional amendments on state ballots in recent years, not just in Virginia, but this is something that is happening all over the country. People go into the voting booth and they're thinking, okay, I'm going to vote for Hillary, or I'm going to vote for Trump, or I'm going to vote for Stein, or I'm going to vote for whoever, right? I'm going to write in Mickey Mouse. But they are not thinking, and I'm going to be asked to vote on the existence of labor unions and whether an abolition of them should be enshrined in the state constitution. They just get in there to vote for whoever they're voting for, and then suddenly this is a question put in front of them. And they aren't prepared for it, and then they click yes or no, depending, and sometimes they don't even understand the questions. That one's not written terribly, but I've seen some that are written so crazily you can't really understand what you're voting for, and you pick a yes or no, and you hit the button.
Well, the League of Women Voters is aware that these things are rather obscure and obtuse, and so we are having a community dialogue on October 25th at the Old County Office Building on McIntyre, in which we discuss the constitutional amendments.
That is great. Yes, I didn't know about that. What time is that happening on the 25th?
This will be, gathering at 11:30. It'll be at noon. And this is the kind of thing that the League of Women Voters does. We are oriented towards education and advocacy, but particularly education and informed citizenry is what we're all about. We're doing a number of community dialogues this year and in 2017, and we do every year. We'll have one on the environment. We'll have one on gun safety. These are the kinds of activities that the League of Women Voters is involved in.
So when you say the Old County Office Building, you're talking about the Lane High School on McIntyre. And that's October 25th at noon. And you guys are going to talk about the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot.
And the ins and outs, because really it could take an hour just alone to talk about the intricacies.
What is amazing to me is that we are seeing this trend whereby constitutions are foundational documents of our democracy, of our commonwealth, of our republic, right? They're foundational documents, and changes are being made to those foundational documents by people who don't anticipate that they're going to be asked to vote on anything foundational, don't necessarily, haven't really prepared or thought about the issue, and you just punch a button and you walk out because you were really there to vote for president. And these kinds of things are done, and then once they're done, they're very difficult to undo.
Well, the interesting thing about this whole election is in a presidential year, people pay attention more. So that's a good time to slip in these propositions in California or amendments here in Virginia. But you also will be not only voting for these, but you'll be voting down ballot. You'll be voting for the House of Representatives. You'll be voting for other offices. And so it's very interesting what may happen with how people will proceed with how they're thinking about what's on their ballot when they go in.
Well, that's true. Whatever is down from the top item that you're thinking about may influence how you vote down the ballot.
It very well may be, and that is going to bring up very interesting questions.
So before we got about 5 minutes left before the end of the show here today, and before we take off, I want to ask you about other sort of resources that may be out there for people. People who what kind of resources are there to get people to the polls? What kind of resources are there for the millennials? What kind of organizations exist in addition to or in cooperation with the League of Women Voters?
Well, one of the important things is actually physically getting people to the polls. And we're getting a number of calls even as early as, they were starting in the summer, which mm-hmm. shows the level of interest in this election, saying, I'm disabled and I don't think I will be able to drive to the polls. Mm-hmm. And how can I get there? Well, several ways. One is the political parties offer rides. Mm-hmm. If you sign up to get a ride, then someone will come and get you. And there was a kind of a funny story that one particular campaign had a call from some little lady who said, I'm going to need a ride to the polls. And she called the Democratic mm-hmm. Headquarters. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we'll be happy to pick you up. Mm-hmm. Give us your address. And
sure.
They did. They took her to the polls. And she went in and voted for the Republican candidate.
Of course. Well, I'm sure they still gave her a ride home.
They gave her a ride home.
Good for them. I mean, it's about getting people out there.
Well, there's also an enterprising person in the community has set up something called CAR to Vote, C-A-R number 2-V-O-T-E. And perhaps we can give them, the listeners, a link to this. But it is a way for people to say, I need a ride, here's my address. And people who are willing to give rides to plug in their information, and they're matched up.
Oh, that's great. So if you're somebody who's thinking, well, I've got a car and, you know, I'm going to be off work that day or whatever, I can give rides. You can sign up on this site to be able to transport people to the polls.
Absolutely.
And it would certainly avoid any awkwardness if you were voting counter to the party who transported you to the polls. but that's neat. I like that. We were talking a little bit before the show about Rock the Vote. Can you tell me, I remember that from way back, you know, when I was young enough to be one of the target audience of that.
Well, this is for the millennials, and it is one of a couple of things that are going on, but celebrities are going to, each year they make a video which appears on YouTube with people that are recognizable immediately, exhorting people to vote, saying, go vote, go vote, and giving the date of the election, because that's the important thing. A lot of people don't know it, and we haven't made it a national holiday, so it's not always known that
although
this
the courts
year
are closed.
It's going to be Tuesday, November 8th.
Tuesday, November 8th. Or you know what? I shouldn't say the courts are closed. I don't know that. But what I do know is that when you go in as an attorney, I go in and schedule cases all the time. Well, we're going to continue this case, or we're going to set this trial for. And the court always says, well, that's election day. So, you know, if you don't want to schedule the case that day, you don't have to, which is pretty cool, I have to say. So is there anything that, you know, you'd like to say to the millennials out there who are contemplating whether or not to go vote this year?
Well, I can say if you're between the age of 18 and 25 and you want to scare the hell out of the people that run this country, this time around, do the unexpected. Take 20 minutes out of your day and do what young people all around the world are dying to do. Vote.
All right. Well, bring it on. The number, by the way, if you want to get a ride to the polls this year, you can certainly look up the CAR to Vote website, C-A-R number 2-V-O-T-E. But there's a phone number as well, which is 260-1547. That's a Charlottesville local phone number. So it's 434-260-1547. If you want a ride to the polls, give that number a ring, and you will get a ride to the polls. Go ahead.
I just would like to close with something that the League of Women Voters has as our sort of motto, and that is, democracy is not a spectator sport.
Amen. Dina, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming here today and taking the time to talk to me. This is 94.7 WPBC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And you have been listening to Straight Talk, which is a local program dealing with law and social justice issues, produced right here in Charlottesville today by our own Ben Chambers, who I have put on the spot several times requesting internet research during this show. Tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. and we'll have another great show for you. I am Audrey Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Audrey Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.